Our subject this week is anthology shows. Now, we can't cover all anthology shows, as it's one of television's most enduring themes, so we're going to kind of limit it to sci-fi and horror, because, you know, I don't know about you, Jason, but I don't know a heck of a lot about the Philco Television Playhouse or, you know, a lot of the stuff that went on in the 50s.
Well, it's funny. I think the reason this topic popped into my head, a couple of weeks ago, I went to Amazon puts on this event every year, like a 4-year consideration thing to get votes for shows and stuff. And they take the Hollywood Athletic Club and they transform different rooms into themed rooms from different shows that they do. But when this thing kicked off one night, they had Matthew Weiner there. Who did Mad Men. I think he wrote on The Sopranos too, but he did Mad Men, and now he's doing this show, The Romanoffs, on Amazon. And The Romanoffs, the connecting thread is the name that a certain character from each episode might sort of be connected to the Romanoffs in some way. But when he was up there talking about it, he mentioned Playhouse 90, and I got to talk to him afterwards about Rod Serling and everything, because he was saying that when he kind of pitched this thing as an idea, he was thinking of the old Playhouse 90 shows, which, you know, Serling, you know, I think Requiem for a Heavyweight and Patterns were two of the big ones that he did. It's one of the things that kind of got him noticed. And it was so refreshing to hear him mention it. And his idea for the Romanoffs was, besides that connecting thread, each story is an individual thing. And I've seen like three of them. But the one that they showed this night, and I'm glad he said this too, was basically kind of a horror movie, not in the sense of, like, you know, monsters or blood and guts, but you're following these two characters, you know, these two Americans in Russia, and the suspense kind of starts to build. Like, you don't even know what they're doing there in the first 20 minutes or so, and it starts to unfold, and then it sort of reaches a certain point, and it's very tense. And it just was a testament to how, depending on the anthology show, that there's a reason I think there's a bit of a renaissance right now with why they're so popular, because you can kind of go anywhere with them, which the brilliant thing about Playhouse 90 and what Serling did, and everybody knows what a massive fan I am of Serling and Twilight Zone and stuff, but he was always running into issues with advertisers and censors. You can't do this, you can't say that. You know, he's got two characters having a cigarette, one lights a match, and then the network comes in and says, oh, well, you have to put a lighter in his hand because, you know, we've got a lighter company as a sponsor, whatever. So the whole gist of the Twilight Zone, I'm sure everybody knows this, but the gist of the Twilight Zone was he was going to be able to get political commentary and, you know, satire and, you know, sort of, you know, warning signs into these stories under the guise of science fiction and fantasy.
I think that's some of the best science fiction and fantasy.
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely. That was the brilliance of there's even an interview with him and Mike Wallace before it launches. And Mike Wallace says, you've had issues with, you know, the networks before, like, so this won't be controversial or political in any way. And Serling's like, no, not at all. This is purely science fiction and fantasy, and that's just an escapism. But as we know, especially in, you know, when you look back, I've been marathoning some of the originals because of the relaunch.
Yeah, that's what spurned this episode on, was not to just have a straight Twilight Zone, you know, discussion, but to have a conversation about the genre itself.
And
this is the wonderful age for the Twilight Zone to return, I think.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to me that suddenly this thing that was, you know, the idea of an anthology, which most networks would probably be scared of, because when you think about it, what are the characters and what happens to them, and you know, how are they playing, what are their ages, what do they look like? We need to put this on the, you know, the posters and the advertising. Well, with anthology shows, there is no continuing cast, but somehow they've found a new audience because of things like Black Mirror, I think, too. And, you know, people are starting to find the value in. So anyway, that, to go back to the Playhouse 90 thing in Twilight Zone, that's I think, you know, what kicked off the anthology stuff, you know, way back. But yeah, so I'm familiar with some of the Playhouse 90. I've got some of the live, you know, DVD sets of some of those shows. But then something happened. I think, you know, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, I think, was like 55 is when it kicked off. And it was mostly kind of, you know, mystery thriller type things. But once you get to the early, very early 60s is when the genre stuff starts to happen, I think.
Yeah,
I'm sure, like, I'm wrong, and there's more stuff that I don't know about.
Well, no, you're kind of right. Like, there was, you know, there was some attempts at it, like Tales of Tomorrow and One Step Beyond, which are shows that I can barely remember. But I think the 60s were very good for horror and science fiction, absolutely. And of course, there was a lot of memorable stuff done at that time. You know, The Twilight Zone being, you know, the most famous, I think, of all of them. But then you had, as you said, Alfred Hitchcock's Presents, which ran 10 years. And
10 years.
Yeah, and then what was the Boris Karloff's Thriller? Do you remember that?
Boris Karloff did, there have been several shows called Thriller, but I think the very first one was Karloff, and I want to say, because Twilight Zone kicked off in 59, I think Thriller was like a year or two later. I don't know if it was an American show. I think it was an American show, and Karloff did the wraparound.
Yeah.
But again, it got into the macabre and the kind of supernatural, I think, here and there, and it sort of, you know, Twilight Zone, you from the launch of it, was you knew was going to be more fantastical and more science fiction, you know, it was that age sort of. But then as it grew, it got, you know, it could be modern, it could be a Western, it could be a futuristic thing, it could be a comedic thing,
a like war
it could
drama,
literally
yeah.
go anywhere. Yeah, but Thriller, I think, was more. And were those half hours? That was a half hour, right?
Yeah, I'm surprised it only lasted two seasons. And
okay.
You know, I guess I thought it lasted longer because of that Gold Key comic that never stopped coming out.
I don't know if I ever put that together, that was the show.
Yeah.
Was the comic.
It actually ran until 79, which, like, Karloff was dead and that show hadn't aired for 17 years. But that was my only connection to... you still there?
A lot of them stick to the 22, 25-minute format, but there's quite a few now that are really playing with the length, you know, length of time that the show, like the Twilight Zone ones have been different lengths, and the Black Mirror ones have been, you know, different lengths at times, and Twilight Zone was a half hour, and so Outer Limits came along, you know, a year or two after Twilight Zone. Outer Limits was an hour-long show.
Yeah.
Which was the half hour thing with kind of the O. Henry ending that Twilight Zone became so famous for, the turn, you know.
Yeah.
There wasn't quite as much in Outer Limit because it was the hour long format, and Twilight Zone, I think, suffered a bit in that fourth season where they were hours, like half hours, the perfect length for such things. But did you, when you were growing up, because I've talked to, our buddy Ned. Everybody, Ned Hastings, who listens to the show, all right, good friend. He says that he didn't remember. He's not that familiar with Twilight Zone.
Oh.
That it didn't run as much where he was, but like Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Outer Limits ran more. What's the story where you grew up?
Oh, Twilight Zone was king. Yeah, it aired on Channel 29 and Channel 79. And we watched, I think, I seem to remember it most from the sixth grade. And it ran, you know, every day, and we were hooked. My dad was a fan, so we watched it together a lot. And, yeah, I can honestly remember being freaked out by episodes and scared by episodes. Outer Limits was tough to find, actually.
Okay, that was, yes. I don't remember. That was an oddity if you found it.
It was on at like, 1 in the morning on the sorry, you know, the Up All Night with Chuck Security Guard show that I would talk about all the time?
Oh,
yeah. That's where I used to watch it. And it was some, you know, that was tough. I mean, I was like 11 trying to watch a show at 1 in the morning. You know, it wasn't, you know, I didn't catch them all. And it scared the crap out of me at that hour.
And you had a job to get to the next morning. You were working in an office.
At the mill,
Yeah, production meetings every morning.
Rendering plant, yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't remember it much. And Alfred Hitchcock, I mean, Twilight Zone was constant. I think it was like every night, or maybe a couple nights a week. But it was that thing where everybody, I watched it with my dad and my brothers. We all knew different episodes, and you'd know it from when it started. And it was just this constant sort of thing. Outer Limits was just sort of stumble across it on a weekend, sort of. And it never got, I don't think it ever had the, people have treated it. I mean, it's a great show. There's great, great stuff in there, but it never, what, you know, part of this is like when I first called you about it was not to go on about this show, but there is a reason that the Twilight Zone is the gold standard. There really is. It is extraordinary. The further away you get from it, the more you watch it and the more you see in other shows just how consistent that show was and how sharp the scripts and the acting and the music cues and just everything. And there's a lot of stuff that tried to get to that vibe, including many remakes that never quite got there. And I feel like Outer Limits kind of wanted to be that, but it never, there's some really good, well, you know about that Outer Limits episode. Oh shit. I'm not going to get this right. There's an Outer Limits episode that's famous that Alan Moore riffed on for Watchmen, for the comic of Watchmen.
Yes, so, that is one of the Architects of Fear.
Architects of Fear, yes. And it is creepy and weird. And, you know, I think I've seen it half a dozen times, and I'm still like, what the hell is going on with it?
The one thing I want to point out about Outer Limits that it did have over Twilight Zone is it had much more of a better design element. You know, the Twilight Zone, the aliens and monsters and such were often really just an afterthought to the story, you know, and probably low budget.
I'd agree with that.
But Outer Limits, they did set out to really create some memorable and quite fantastic character designs in the aliens. I mean, they're incredibly iconic, and, you know, kids our age would, you know, you pick up these books in the library or Famous Monsters, and they were littered with Outer Limits photos. I mean, they were just amazing.
Oh, yeah. Like
the Ebonites and the Architects of Fear creature and things like that, and of course the Zanti Misfits. The iconic and memorable and kind of awesome. But that's
exactly what it sort of, I think, is remembered for the most.
Yes.
Is the creature of the week kind of thing, or the monster of the week, whatever
you want
to call
it. Well, I think it degraded into that too. Like the first season had some real winners, man. The Man Who's Never Born, Demon with a Glass Hand, Architects of Fear. These were, you know, really good stories with, you know, snap endings and interesting stuff. But as the second season rolled around, it started to. I'm still there. We're having some little bumps in the road. The second
season, the Outer Limit.
Yeah, this is the control voice. The second season,
Demon with a Glass Hand. Was that Robert Culp in that one? Demon with a Glass Hand.
Actually, Robert Culp was both in Architects of Fear and Demon with a Glass Hand, I believe.
Oh, cool.
And Demon with a Glass Hand is an Ellison story, and it's excellent. It's really excellent.
That's the one. No, that might not be the one. Well, there is a famous episode. Maybe it is Demon with a Glass Hand. No, shit. Ellison did another one that basically when the Terminator came out, and this is why I always, people argue about James Cameron.
Yeah.
Soldier, yes. Now, I think that was Ellison, and it basically
it
was.
It definitely was.
The story of the Terminator where the person comes back, you know, goes back in time to stop the birth of a da-da-da-da-da. And, of course, being Ellison, he went, you know, ape shit when he saw it, and every subsequent print had to have thank you, you know, with acknowledgement to the works of Harlan Ellison after the original theatrical print, like the video print and everything else.
Yeah,
had to have
you know,
that.
he sued the hell out of, you know, he was a litigious guy, and I believe he claimed that, you know, elements of Soldier and elements of Demon with a Glass Hand were used in the Terminator, and you know, I've never really fully analyzed it, or, you know, I know Cameron really hates the notion that he stole the Terminator. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, to be fair, you know, Avatar, he stole from about a dozen different science fiction sort of things and elements and stories. When I was at the LA Art Show, had a great chat with Mr. Roger Dean, legendary artist Roger Dean, fantasy album cover artist and fantasy artist. He did the logo for the band Yes. That's Roger Dean. And he apparently sued Cameron as well for a couple of his paintings that had planets as these floating kind of things that were in Avatar. And they went after Cameron for that. I don't know if they won or what it was, but it was saying, you clearly looked at my stuff and took these ideas or whatever. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I'm just saying the Ellison thing wouldn't necessarily be the first time that, well, it would be the first time, but not the only time that Cameron, somebody went, hey, wait a second. But yeah, no, I don't know what Ellison got out of it besides the acknowledgement.
Oh, I think he got some money.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, I guess, I mean, it's hard to watch, especially Soldier, and not think of the Terminator instantly.
Yeah,
but then again, you know,
I've never read the case or, yeah, there's definitely some similarities with Soldier.
Yeah. So like you said, they're in that first season, I think, is where the stories, you know, match the creatures for inventiveness and, you know, really, there's some really dark, strange stuff. I think Outer Limits actually went far stranger and kind of more brutal than Twilight Zone did at times.
Yeah.
Twilight Zone, they were more allegorical and they weren't quite as, but I think sometimes Outer Limits just came right out and said it and was much more graphic about it, which I love it for too.
Yeah.
That lasted, three seasons?
Two seasons. And then its remake, which actually I thought was fantastic in the 90s, lasted seven seasons.
Oh, the remake. So that launched, I remember that launched with a, in fact, some of these might be on Amazon Prime or the 90s, because one of them was a Nimoy was in one of them.
Yes.
About the robot that killed
iRobot,
iRobot kills his master or whatever, and then Nimoy defends him, and it was directed by Adam Nimoy, his son, I guess, if I remember this correctly.
Yeah.
And I think I might have read that in Starlog, but I could be wrong.
And Desi Liu, you probably did. I remember that. It was in one of those Starlog, you know, those yearbooks they used to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the stuff, too, ended up on Star Trek, because these were both Desi Liu productions. And Outer Limits also got a whole bunch of merchandise, like board games and comic books and things like that, puzzles, because
yeah,
of these
iconic
monsters they made.
I think they might have had bubblegum cards, maybe?
Yes,
am I wrong?
They did. Yeah, they did.
Because Twilight Zone got nothing. I mean, Twilight Zone, I think there was a board game and there was a comic book.
That lasted forever.
Right. And I think that was really it until Sideshow did a couple of 12-inch figures, and then we came along to do all the stuff that we did. There really wasn't anything
you
happening.
You guys really ran it through the end zone there.
Well, thank you. But that, again, was my initial notion was going to be monsters. It was going to be the Gremlin, and it was going to be the Cannonit, and it was going to be, you know, I really didn't know, because nothing had been done. I wasn't sure if human characters were going to fly. And then as soon as we started making stuff, you had all these people saying, when are you going to make Shatner? And you better make Burgess Meredith, and I hope you do this. And then it was clear that there was an audience beyond just the monsters, because Twilight Zone wasn't just known for the monsters and the creatures and stuff.
No.
Whereas Outer Limits, you could do a whole toy line of the amazing creatures. What was reused for Star Trek? Which ones?
As I recall, there was a couple of monsters reused, like one of them Captain Pike fights in the pilot, the Cage, and that is that's a monster that was used on an Outer Limits episode, and I can't name it, but a few of the people that actually worked on the show, like both worked on Outer Limits, went over to Star Trek, and the one name that I remember is Hua Chang, who sculpted Mr. Spock's ears and did other things like that. He's a very talented sculptor. But there was a couple. I think the Horta is also a monster from an Outer Limits episode.
I did not know that. I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah.
And wow! I've got the Outer Limits somewhere. I've got to rewatch some of this. But yes, I think I only saw the first season of the Outer Limits remake. And then we'll get to the Twilight Zone remake, because that's another
one?
Thing that kind of kicked this off.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of what kicked it off. But there was also a British show. I thought there was a British show called Chiller in the early 60s that they then brought back in 95. They brought it back. I think they only did one season of it in 95. And I found it not too long ago, and you can sort of, there's a few faces that pop up in it that you kind of recognize that ended up doing much, much bigger things. But there's a great British show from the early 70s called Thriller.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think lasted like three series and a lot of episodes. But it was done by, I want to say, Brian Clemens did it, who... was it Brian Clemens? Yeah, I think it was. You remember that show? What was that show called in the mid-70s in the UK? It was called Monsters?
Yeah, not in the UK. Monsters, no. Beasts?
Beasts.
Yeah,
that's
Beasts.
It.
Yeah,
Beasts.
Yeah. That's
a weird freaking show. That is a really weird show. Nigel Neal. Okay, so Quatermass, Nigel Neal.
Yeah.
I think this Thriller thing was, I want to say Brian Clemens maybe did it, or, you know, wrote quite a bit of more creative it or something. I don't remember exactly, but it's a good show. It's, again, it's, you watch it and it's just all you see is beige. Everybody's in beige kind of clothing, flares, cigarettes, and scotch.
Yeah.
Like in every episode, somebody, hello, darling. Oh, hello, darling. How was it? Oh, hello, darling. He goes right over to the cabinet, gets out a thing, makes a thing of scotch, da 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 da. Like, well, that's my memory of most of those episodes. And those, I think those are on Amazon Prime, too.
Oh, really?
They're running that series. Yeah, but it's dark. It's not quite as supernatural, but there's some really weird, dark, Hitchcockian stuff in there. But it's funny because... talking to Alex, you know, as we do these marathon phone calls, because he doesn't use the damn, you know, texting or anything, we were talking about stuff, and he mentioned a show that I would have completely forgotten. It would never popped into my head ever. Do you remember a show called The Dark Room?
Yeah, James Coburn.
Like,
I was going to bring it up. Yeah.
James Coburn.
Scared the crap
and
out of
the
me.
The entire series is on YouTube.
Oh, no,
like,
way.
Like, somebody put up all... And there, I think there's only like seven or eight episodes. That's all they got to make. But I remember watching that when it aired, and it creeped me out.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Creeped me out. Oh, okay, good. All right. So yeah, just I would have completely forgotten about it. He mentioned it. I then found it, and I'm suddenly watching Coburn for the. My eyes are on this thing for the first time since I was a 10 or whatever.
Yeah, I haven't seen.
You know.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, I watched the first episode, and there's some good stuff in it, but it was. I think they like at that point they kind of started to see. So you also had, you know, back to Twilight Zone, Serling, and all this stuff that sort of everybody sort of uses that as I still say as the gold standard. So if someone was to pitch a show, an anthology thing, what would it be like? Is it more like Twilight Zone? Is it more like this or whatever? And Serling, you know, also because the Twilight Zone did so well in syndication, they approached him about doing the Night Gallery. Which he thought initially he was going to have much more involvement in and much more, you know, creative kind of role in. But, you know, he wrote a few scripts and he did the wraparounds and stuff. And that was a kind of a strange show, too, because it had you know, multiple stories per hour. You know, sometimes it was three stories, sometimes it was two half hours, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was too saddled to the horror element, I found. Like, I think we've discussed it in our Serling episode, but it also didn't have his creative control, and that showed.
Yeah, it felt like there's some doozies. There's some real good ones, you know, that hold up. But yeah, it didn't have the you kind of felt Serling all over the Twilight Zone, where you didn't feel it all over Night Gallery.
The most frustrating thing about Night Gallery is, of course, we're too young to remember the original run, so you'd watch it in syndication. And in my case, they only played it like Sunday at 4, like two episodes Sunday at 4. So you really had to like be patient. And it would run into those stupid, they padded the show out with another failed show called Sixth Sense, starring Gary Collins. Do you remember that? And so
I remember them padding it out with these dumb little 10-minute comedic things.
Oh, I remember that,
you mean
too.
That?
No, Sixth Sense was another show, but they shoved it in the Night Gallery and actually would, like, they would have the Night Gallery intro, and then it would go, tonight's episode is Sixth Sense. And you'd be like, oh, no, because Sixth Sense was kind of like, I don't know, some sort of supernatural show with Gary Collins. And
I remember that.
Oh, good. You blocked it out. I really, really hated those, and it drove me crazy because, you know, you had to write out a whole season of Sixth Sense, and then that was not fun.
I don't think I remember that.
Mm.
I mean, we've mentioned this before on the show, but I remember you had your version of, like, horror theater or whatever. We had a thing called Horror Incorporated, which went down this hallway that had like sort of death masks of a bunch of famous, you know, horror people. And then you had the voice, tonight on Horror Incorporated, it's, you know, Frankenstein meets the blah, 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 whatever. I mean, I'm talking little kid. These are very, very early, images, memories of such things. And it, to me, it's kind of married up with Night Gallery, because I remember Night Gallery being a late night show, maybe on a Friday or Saturday night, and being disturbing to me. And it was, when, I guess if you're five or whatever, and you're seeing this, you know, there's the paintings at the beginning of Night Gallery, and or some of the stories are just terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, the paintings are more terrifying than most anything in the show.
Do you remember they used to sell those in magazines, prints of those?
They sold prints of them, yes.
Yeah.
That's right. I've actually got a print, a small print, because that artist, they did an event over in Burbank last year with the guy who painted those. Yeah, I think Guillermo del Toro has a few of the originals, and he brought some of the originals to this thing. Yeah, as a matter of fact, yes, they sold those posters in the back of, I think, Famous Monsters or maybe even Starlog and stuff. There was like a set of five or six posters. But that artist who did all those, they had a gallery show for him at Creature Features in Burbank like a year ago or so. And he brought several of his original paintings that he still has. You couldn't photograph any of them, but then there was sort of an artist thing where they had commissioned a bunch of artists to do original stuff to celebrate this thing, and Serling and him and everything. And they had these prints that you could buy, and I had him sign the two that I got. He signed them, and I don't know where they are right now, but they're terrifying. I mean, some of them don't even match up with the, isn't there, there's one too, where he uses the image of Lon Chaney Jr. as the Phantom, I think.
Oh, you could be right, yeah.
I think there's one, and there's one I texted you about way back, was a vampire coming into a funeral home to arrange a funeral. And it's Werner Klemperer is the vampire, and Joe Flynn is the owner of the funeral home. And then, you know, when they get, because you realize the vampire is planning his own funeral or something. And then when you get to the funeral, all these sort of very low budget Universal type monsters are in the church,
yeah,
kind of thing. But it was just none more early 70s than Werner Klemper in the scene with Joe Flynn. You know, one of the materials for hell is, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it, so it had some of that, and the tone was kind of off. Because the great thing about Twilight Zone is there was stuff that was played kind of light, stuff that was definitely comedy, stuff very dark. It kind of went all, you know, all over the place. But what I was going to say about the, I remember I came across the 80s Twilight Zone in a DVD set a while back, and I got it because I hadn't seen, I think I only saw the bulk of the first season, and I don't remember it. But I remember it being kind of a big deal when it hit. So it hit in 85 on CBS Prime.
Oh, yeah, the remake of Twilight Zone, yeah.
Remake. And it would, their thing was, well, look, you know, the movie did pretty well. It didn't, it wasn't, you know, a runaway success, but did pretty well. We should do something with this. And so they started the 1985, the new Twilight Zone. And there were some really big names involved. And back to Harlan Ellison, they had him as like a script consultant or a supervising producer.
I want to say Philip DeGuerra was involved with that show.
Philip DeGuerra was involved. George R.R. Martin wrote some scripts and some stories. Harlan Ellison and what's his name? William Friedkin directed some. I think Martha Coolidge. Like, there's some. They got some big names.
I think O'Bannon was in an episode.
Dan O'Bannon. They had people like Melinda Dillon was in an episode, and like some, you know, some kind of B or C list, you know, not nobodies, but some pretty decent.
Yeah, Bruce Willis kicked off the episode. The first episode was called Shatter Day. And I just recently rewatched that. I occasionally revisit it. I did not like it when it first came out. But now, you know, I've rewatched a few episodes, and there were some diamonds in that rough. There were some good episodes.
Totally. I what I was going to say was, I feel like having watched quite a bit of it now, I feel like it's every 8 or 9 episodes you get to one that's pretty good.
Yeah.
There was a lot of stuff that was kind of filler, that was just kind of too light or too. The problem with it, it's funny because I actually watched a couple and then rewatched them just to hear Harlan Ellison's commentary.
Oh, wow.
Which is fascinating in itself, because everyone from the prop guy to the guy who shot it, to Bruce Willis himself, to how it was directed, to how Bruce Willis acted in it, to what he did with his voice, everything is wrong. For Ellison, in each of these commentaries, everything about the thing was wrong, and it should have been done differently, or if he had directed it, or I directed it. And then one of them is based on a Stephen King short story or something.
Yeah, that could
and
be.
And it just goes... And it's like Barrett Oliver, the kid from Neverending Story, is the lead. And it's got to do with having to go feed grandma and she's a monster or something. And it just, the whole thing is this kid, this whole thing is the monologue in this kid's head. And it's total Ellison. Well, he's looking at it and commenting on it like he just made Jaws. Like, this is the greatest thing I've ever. There's one of them in the commentary where he says, and this upcoming scene, of all the things I've ever done, if this upcoming scene ends up being the thing I'm most remembered for, I would be okay with it. And then the scene rolls and you go, it's okay. I mean, it's no City on the Edge of Forever, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So he just, it's fascinating listening to his stuff. But the thing is, from what I understand, they did 2 seasons, didn't do that well. They pushed it to 3 so they could get into syndication. And then the third one was in Canada. They got a different opening narrator.
Yeah, that was actually Robin Ward, who was on The Star Lost. He was
Robin, you mean they did the...
Yeah, he was
the opening...
He was, you know, instead of Martin Sheen, they had Robin Ward, which I always thought was kind of hilarious. And he ended up being a weatherman later on in life. So he quit acting, and he was a weatherman on TV.
Well, it's funny, because one of Ellison's comments in the... one of the episodes, he mentions the guy, because the guy who did the opening for the first 2 seasons, the opening and closing, he's the guy who was in the original Twilight Zone. I can't think of his name, but he's got a beautiful voice. And Ellison was going on about how great his voice is, but he said when it went to syndication, they didn't want to have to pay him more for more episodes, so they got some other guy in Canada or whatever. I'm not sure he even said the guy's name in Canada, who that guy was. But it was one of those things where each episode there's a face and then a full Canadian cast, like someone that would be known in Canada but not maybe in the U.S. So
yeah,
like,
and it's unfortunately indicative of really like late 80s Toronto productions. They kind of have this look about them, and they I'm not, you know, like they also did a season of Airwolf in Canada, and you know,
really?
The only reason I watch those now, like I would like to actually pick up some of those, is that I grew up in Toronto in the 1980s, and it is kind of fun to see, you know, record stores that you don't that don't exist anymore. Like somebody was talking to me about the Friday the 13th series, and it's like I really got to pick that one up and watch it, because it was all just filmed downtown Toronto in the late 80s, and it's a time capsule.
Yeah, there's one episode with Paul LaMatte is the lead. And the first thing you realize is, wow, it's only 1988. But boy, American Graffiti seems like a long time ago.
It does, yeah,
Paul LaMatte.
Yeah, yeah.
Even in 88, it looks like he had made some bad choices. But that one, they drive all over Toronto, like all over the place. But
yeah,
half the episode is outdoor locations and little diners and restaurants and stuff. But it's got this overall kind of feel. I feel like some of the gems you're talking about in the early stuff, it sort of fell into this poignant kind of thing rather than the chill up your spine kind of thing. A lot of them went the sort of, oh, why am I attracted to this woman? Well, it turns out you've got the heart of her dead husband.
Yeah.
Transferred into you. A lot of it ended up being that kind of stuff. And it kind of missed the point, I think, of Twilight Zone. Or some of it kind of hit you over the head. Which, much as I love Jordan Peele, and I don't want to go into too much of that because lots of people probably haven't seen it yet, Jordan Peele, I'll see anything he does.
Yeah.
I will. He's got me, and I love that he's a monster guy and a sci-fi guy. Going after Twilight Zone is a tough, that's a tough mark, you know, like you've got a lot to go up against. And I'm four episodes in, and it wasn't until the fourth episode that I thought, now they're getting the feel for what this show is.
What's the fourth episode? I've only seen one episode.
The fourth one is with Greg Kinnear as a sheriff.
Okay, that's the only episode I've seen.
And
I did kind of like the little it really wasn't a big shocking twist ending, but I did kind of like the sentiment behind the ending, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but the idea behind that the alien invasion wouldn't be scary for everyone is an interesting thought. I liked that a lot.
Well, but also what I liked about it was you were kind of uneasy throughout the episode.
They built tension nicely through the whole show.
They built tension nicely. There was a weirdness. You weren't sure exactly what was going on, and it kind of jumped around a bit, and it was strange. But I haven't felt like that in the other three. In fact, of them sort of, you know, hit you over the head. There's interesting ideas, but it's a tough nut to crack. It's just tough to do that, which is why I say, and we've got lots more stuff to talk about, but which is why I say, and I've said this a dozen times on this show, and I keep saying it, I'll say it again, pound for pound, and I'm going to make this statement here, pound for pound, episode for episode, across the board, the TV series, and I haven't seen everything ever made, don't get me wrong, but the TV series that I think is the heir apparent to the Twilight Zone is Inside Number 9.
They've talked about that.
Yes, they've done four series. It's Reese Shearsmith and Steve Pemberton out of The League of Gentlemen. They write every one of them. They star in every one of them as different characters. Wonderful casts in each of these. I mean, great British actors. But six episodes a season, four seasons, and they truly can take it anywhere they want to go. The only through line is the number 9, where if you're at an address, it's number 9, or a boardroom, it's number 9, or whatever. The story takes place.
That's the thing. Like, there used to be a Western anthology show, very few of these, but called Dead Man's Gun. And that was the connecting piece, was that gun every week.
Was the gun. That's right. I've never seen that, but I know what you're talking about.
That was actually created by the guy who created Kung Fu.
That's why I know what that show is, that I've ever even heard of that show. But yes, that's the idea. So you could come into the camera pushes into a restaurant, and the restaurant is called The Nine or Nine or whatever, and you're in there, and you're in the restaurant for the entire episode, or you're in the boardroom for the entire, and you don't even realize until the show wraps up that you haven't left this location. It's one location each episode. It's a different one. Could be kind of, you know, the witch, you know, Salem witch trial kind of thing. One of them can be, you know, it just, it's always got a through line of kind of the macabre or kind of the sinister or the strange, or, but it's also got a humor to it that, I mean, there's one that's heartbreaking. That's just absolutely, I've seen it multiple times and it's heartbreaking. I'm still seeing them and catching little things I didn't catch the first two or three times because it's the scripts are so tight. But I would say, as quality goes, for that number of episodes, there's nothing can touch, not even Black Mirror, nothing touches Inside Number Nine. So I cannot recommend it enough. Season 1 through 3 on Amazon, I believe. Season 4, I think you have to get a BritBox subscription or something. But oh. And then, of course, they did a live Halloween episode last year on the BBC, a live broadcast. And I don't want to ruin it, but just find it if you can find it, because it's genius what they did and how they blew up Twitter with this live broadcast.
No kidding.
But so Darkroom. So but Darkroom had some names involved with it too, and I want to say Daguerre. Well, here's what I was going to say. Okay, so Darkroom was 81.
Yeah, 82. Yeah.
In between, we have two shows that made me think of this, which may not quite be anthology. Okay, first of all. There was a show called Cliffhangers, right?
Yeah, Cliffhangers was, I don't know if you'd call it, it was like a serial, but you had, you know, three different themes, and they actually were going to retire, like, if the show had continued, they retired things, like, they, you know, the Dracula series wrapped up, they were going to make another series after that, so, yeah, I guess...
With a different character, you mean?
Yeah, different characters.
Like, they would have lost Dracula?
Yeah, like okay. They had, you know, they had Cliffhangers had three segments. They had so this, and I can't remember the name, but the Girl Reporter segment, and then they had the Phantom Empire, which was a remake of the 1930s Gene Autry serial, and which was, you know, an underground kingdom with robots and all that. And then
awesome.
The third one was Dracula. And I actually had to – I tracked down – it's not available on DVD, so I found some bootlegs of Cliffhangers. And, yeah, it's fun. It's a fun show to watch. It's one of those things that – I don't know if you'd call it an anthology series, but it's one of those things you see as a kid and it gets canceled real quick and you become obsessed with it.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I thought we talked about it once.
I'm sure we have.
And you said they were gonna flip the, they were gonna change the characters or change the stories.
Yeah, they were gonna add a new series
for the next season or
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the other one that springs to mind that I think is an anthology show, pretty much, is Fantasy Island.
Oh, absolutely.
One of your yeah. favorite things of all time,
and something actually kind of obsessing about right now because they're playing it on a local channel and. I'm like my whole family's into this. My daughter was, I fell asleep last night, and my daughter was texting me like, "Paul Williams is in this one," and it's like, "Wow, you're watching Fantasy." Like, when my dad went to bed, I would watch like, you know, R-rated stuff.
Is something near and dear to your heart that I think is an anthology show, pretty much, is Fantasy Island.
Oh, absolutely.
Which you're very into.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with right now because it's playing on a local station. And not only am I into it, but my wife and kids are into it, too. My daughter was watching it after I went to bed late last night, and I found that kind of funny because, you know, when my dad went to bed, I just wanted to watch, you know, risque material on television and hopefully see the nudity. But my daughter actually just went through my DVR and found a Fantasy Island with Paul Williams on it, who she likes, and watched that.
What did she text? She texted you? What'd she text you?
Paul Williams is really short. Did you know that? I'm like, oh, fascinating bit of information.
You must have been beaming.
I was amused.
You must have been beaming with pride that you saw that text, though.
I was very amused. That was a nice thing to wake up to.
That's pretty freaking cool.
Yeah, and it vacillates from comedy to, you know, drama to, you know, horror and adventure, and, you know, you know what you're getting by who's in the cast, you know, and I love it because it's just such a it was a concept, you know, I was 10 years old when it came out, I guess, or and I just thought it was a great concept for a kid, and it would have you know, elements of horror. You know, there's a Frankenstein episode, there's a hilariously ridiculous Dracula episode with Robert Reed playing Dracula.
Oh, hello.
Full perm and mustache. And it's such a time trip, and it's wonderful to see all these faces in it too. You know, there's a lot of like, you know, my daughter says it's like the washed up actors. But I said, well, no, she actually, it's washed up actors and people who had hit shows on ABC at the time. So, you know, like, I think Fred Grandy's in it a whole bunch. And
it was a huge show. It was a hit show.
It was a big show.
There was only three networks. If you wanted to get some work, if you were want to stay relevant, you're on a show like that. Plus, for a lot of actors, especially people like Paul Williams, little known fact, their salary, they were paid in cocaine.
Oh, really?
I don't know if people know that, yeah. So there was a lot of coke going around in Hollywood back then, so easy way to move, shift some merchandise.
Did you know, I didn't know this, but they're making a Fantasy Island movie right now. It's a horror film. And
you know, hasn't this been rumored for a long time that they brought it back with Malcolm McDowell. They did a remake.
I would really, really like to see that again.
It was creepy. It had some good stuff in it. I saw two of the episodes, and it felt like they were already trying to go further with the Rourke mythology, maybe, or that it was going to be something more than it needed to be. Because the show never explain, you know, the island is on a fault line where fantasy, where two dimensions that come. They never explain what the frick the island is,
no,
or who Rourke is. It's just how do you book a tour of Fantasy Island? Like, how do you get such things? And then people talk about it when they get back and say, you're not going to believe what happened. I hung out with the devil. Or do they forget to get on the plane? Or
there's a suspension of disbelief, and that's my favorite thing about it is you watch it and you're like, okay, like, how come they have, you know, like, one, they have a jungle natives here. And then you go this way, and there's actually a red light district with a porno theater, and you know it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And I think that's the part of it is it's a land of make believe, and they go all over the place with Mr. Rourke. I mean, he marries a woman in one episode, which you have to see Mr. Rourke's leisure wear, which is, you know, like mesh shirts.
Wait. Rourke, he marries a woman?
He marries a woman. She's dying of cancer, and he marries a woman, and he adopts the son, who you never see again. And
I didn't think we ever went into their personal lives at all, other than
Tattoo. Oh, yeah, there's a Tattoo gets a fantasy episode.
I just knew he got a mischief. That's all I remember about
Tattoo. Yeah, well, that was the fun thing, is if, like, the first season, Tattoo always has a shtick at the start, you know, like he's going to direct films this week, and then the next week he's, you know, he's going to sell insurance, and they kind of kibosh that after a while. But yeah,
wasn't playing well.
I don't know. We were kind of betting on, you know, he'd show up with a ventriloquist dummy or, you know, that sort of thing. It's gotta be a little humiliating for that guy. You know, they paired him with a chimpanzee. They make his character kind of an idiot, and then they make him drive a little tiny car, you know, on the show. And it's like, it was a pretty humiliating gig you got there, you know?
It was, and clearly he wasn't happy about it.
No.
If my interview with Hervé is anything to go by.
Yeah, no, and I think he let it go to his head a little bit, too. But, I mean, I always joke to my wife, like, that guy probably couldn't pick up his dry cleaning without some asshole going, da plane, like it must have been a nightmare.
Brutal.
You know, and it's not like he could put
brutal.
A hat on and no one would know who he was, you know.
And the only thing worse would be being, you know, 5 years removed from the show or whatever, and it still happens everywhere you go.
Oh, yeah. Unemployed, and you're still getting harassed. The episodes I love the best are, like, the fantasy and horror ones, of course. And, you know, there's some, you know, it's not, it's TV, you know, with sensors, it doesn't really cross over to too much scary. You'd have to be a kid to be scared of it. But, you know, Roddy McDowall is the devil, Rourke fighting Satanists. And the other thing I'm really having fun with is seeing all the stunt doubles and that sort of thing.
Which always cracks me up, because I was watching actually a Twilight Zone a couple weeks ago, or an original one, and this fight went on forever, and the two guys could not look less like the two actors in the show if they tried. This isn't black and white, you know, but you realize that TV screens were tiny. Like, you would never have caught this when it aired. They weren't sitting there thinking, one day this will be in, you know, 70-inch television in high def. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's yeah. So I love that stuff, too, that you know, in Star Trek, there's a lot of that in Star Trek, too, where the Shatner double is just, like,
well,
you know, some 9 foot tall.
I was watching Fantasy Island the other day, and it was a caveman episode. And, again, they have dinosaurs and everything.
Sweet.
Nobody, but the two women fight, and they're very attractive women. They're very beautiful women. No wonder they put them. But when the fight happens, I'm positive it's two dudes in wigs. And, you know, you're just killing yourself laughing. And you're like, but it's just like, you know, when I watch Kung Fu, you can see all the bald cap lines now. Or, you know, TV, like you said, was never meant to be this big and beautiful and detailed. So you're gonna see all the stuff that they could bury at one time that no one would see, you know?
I bought the box set of Barney Miller.
Oh, wow.
And I haven't seen, this is a show that never pops up.
Yeah.
And I wish it did, because it might be the best sitcom or American sitcom ever made, because.
But you must see all the stunt doubles.
Well, what I was going to say was the boom, the mics.
Yeah. Oh, the boom mics. Yeah. Well, that could,
you know,
have to
do
with trying to get them into an HDTV like surround as well, right? Like.
Yeah, I mean, the way this thing was shot was like they shot this over a couple. They rehearsed for like a week, I think, each episode, and they shot for like 2 days maybe.
Yeah.
And I think after the first two or three seasons, there was no audience, so they had a laugh track. But they shot them like a play. You know, and sometimes the camera goes a little too left, a little too right, and you almost see the corner of the set kind of thing. And it's just charming, and I just love it. But it's something you know, they weren't thinking this thing's going to be around for 40-some years. And
exactly.
We're going to dissect it. So was Rourke, here's the thing. This is what fascinates me about Fantasy Island. Fantasy Island to me always seemed like Love Boat seemed like, and maybe this is a 70s thing. What year was Fantasy Island? Was it 80?
It crossed over. No, I think it started with TV movies in the, I would say, the late 70s, like 78 or 77. And then I think it went to series like in 79, if I'm not
mistaken.
Maybe
this is a 70s thing, because, I mean, because you could say this about Three's Company, Love Boat, ostensibly, you know, Three's Company is ostensibly like, you know, slapstick, you know, silliness. Love Boat is, you know, cheesy bubblegum type romance.
Yeah.
Fantasy Island was the fantasy thing, but there's sex in all of this stuff.
Oh yeah.
There's, I mean, you know, the innuendo in Three's Company and the sex and the Love Boat, you know, what they're going to the cabin for, whatever. And yet they, you know, Three's Company got gum cards. Love Boat got gum cards and toys. Fantasy Island got Halloween costumes and, you know, marker sets and probably coloring books.
And a really fun board game.
When you watch it now, do you feel like it's sort of, was it trying to be a kid show that had some adult stuff in it, or what was the?
I think it had to do with that. Like, TV was, network TV was for everybody. You know, there was very few shows. Like, I actually had a neighbor that his parents wouldn't let him watch Three's Company. And
it's pretty filthy. For the time.
Is it though? It's, I don't know. And
I'm watching Barney Miller. There's episodes like in 76. The innuendo about, you know, with fish, with like what he can or can't get up to, let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
It's kind of shocking. The prostitute jokes and the sex jokes, the innuendo's there. I'm not to mention the race stuff, which is like, you know, they just let it all hang out, which, you know, but you know, there's, yeah, I mean, you wouldn't get this stuff necessarily as a kid, but if you were an adult and you got those jokes and you knew what they were referring to, I don't know. I mean, I guess. I mean, you're talking to someone who was, you know, watching Monty Python when he was seven.
Yeah.
So I didn't get all the sex jokes, but I saw boobies. You know, I don't know why my parents let me watch that, but I mean, so you think it was just like, you know, this is what's on, gets big numbers. Some of those numbers are going to be kids. Let's make a Halloween costume.
I guess. I think it was just, you know, what the bandwidth was. And Fantasy Island was a highly rated show. So you went with highly rated, recognizable shows. I can't imagine, like, I own that costume, obviously, but I can't imagine anyone really, like, who wanted to go as Tattoo? Like,
no, I can't imagine the kid wanting to go as ostensibly a kid or a small person.
Yeah.
They'd want to go as, like, Darth Vader or...
Although I did, you know, I did really think Robin was cool as a kid, and a lot of people don't quite understand that.
Really?
Yeah, but I liked that teen Robin. Like, I was kind of looking up to that, like, you know, 19-year-old Robin that Neil Adams was drawing. So, you know, it wasn't that I wanted to be Rob. I wanted to grow up to be Robin, you know, like he was. And maybe I just, you know, I had my my expectations at a reasonable level. Like, I'm never going to be Batman, but I could be Robin, you know.
See, that makes sense, and that's why I think that the teen sidekick would probably work in a show.
Yeah.
The kid thing, I've never understood the logic with the kid thing. Let's
yeah,
make it a kid. Kids are going to want to be that kid. It's like, no, they're not. They're going to hate that kid.
Yeah.
Little kids are going to hate that kid because they get to hang out with Indiana Jones or whatever. It's stupid.
Yeah, they're
so I guess we'd... So I call that an anthology show.
Yeah.
Dark Room was anthology. You had the remake of The Twilight Zone in 85.
Actually, I think the 80s were a golden age because of the expansion of cable channels. We had hundreds of them in the 80s. You had Friday the 13th, the series, which we already talked about a little bit. Tales from the Crypt.
Tales from the Dark Side.
The syndicated shows, Tales from the Dark Side, which was excellent. And then it kind of just rebooted as Monsters. Do you remember Monsters?
Yes, I do. In fact, I just came across that again.
And I would say the pilot episode of Monsters, which is called The Fever Man, is one of the best pieces. I think it's one of the best anthology episodes. It's right up there with Outer Limits or Twilight.
I beg your pardon?
It's called
the what?
The Fever Man.
Oh, The Fever Man.
Yeah, it's the pilot of Monsters. And, you know, Monsters kind of went all over the place. It was, you know, it did a lot of humor and black comedy. But that first episode was probably my favorite of the series, and it really left an indelible mark on me. I love it. It stars David McCallum, and it's about, you know.
Oh,
it's a.
I just watched it.
Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent episode of it. Like,
I found it a few months back on Prime, and I just watched that because David McCallum. That's right.
Yeah.
I knew that sounded familiar.
Yeah.
But it seemed like I tried to dip into a couple others, and it seemed like they were kind of more goofy than.
Yeah, it got like Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira play werewolves in an episode, and it did
classic.
Kind of go. You didn't know what you were going to get with that show.
Okay. But that was... So Monsters was Tales from the Dark Side.
Yeah, it's the same... It's the same series, basically. Like, I forget exactly why they did this. I guess it was the same producer. I don't understand. It was Tales from the Dark Side, and then they ended that, and they came up with Monsters. So,
and was that a Canadian thing too?
No, not at all.
Funny. Okay. But Tales from the Dark Side, I remember being, what year was Tales from the Dark Side?
Tales from the Dark Side, I think, was like 83, 84, and it ran until 88, and then Monsters came out.
I remember Tales from the Dark Side being pretty creepy. Am I wrong?
A great starting, and I guess originally, I just was looking at the Wikipedia of it. It was supposed to be called Creepshow, but there was some legal entanglement, so they just called it Tales from the Dark Side. which, you know, was sort of like based on they kept the comic kind of thing out, but there was some Stephen King, there was some Harlan Ellison, there was some Clive Barker, Robert Bloch, there was some very established horror authors in this show being adapted.
Okay, now that, see, I gotta look back into this monsters thing, because that was...
Do you remember the Tales from the Dark Side movie, too?
Yes, I couldn't tell you who was in it, or what...
Debbie Harry and Steve Buscemi, yeah.
Oh, with Steve Buscemi and Christian Slater?
Yeah.
Was it something to do with Steve Buscemi was like an archaeologist, or he worked at a museum regarding a mummy or something?
Yeah, he had a mummy, and I think he was using it to exact revenge, if I recall.
Fight crime.
Yeah. you've seen my screenplay.
He was using it to buy some beer.
Yeah.
To get him beer because he didn't have an ID. Yes, I remember that movie. Yes. And then it sort of, I don't remember much in the 90s. It was like an anthology. There was loads of syndicated stuff, but nothing really. I remember the 80s was like kind of a haven.
Well, yeah, the 80s, they had The Hitchhiker, and they had Ray Bradbury Theater, which was all Canadian.
Ray Bradbury Theater. Yeah. Yes, that was Canadian, too.
Yes.
But they got names. They got, like, Peter O'Toole, and Shatner was in one. I mean, Shatner was in everything, let's be honest. But they got some big names in the Ray Bradbury thing.
Yeah, and Freddy's Nightmares was around that time. There were some Freddy's Nightmares. Yeah, I didn't really dig that, but... yeah, the 80s was really a big time. And then I think anthologies in the 90s, other than the reboot of The Outer Limits, I'm just trying to think. And, of course, like Tales from the Crypt was still going strong. The things I remember that got really big in the 90s were kids and horror anthologies like Goosebumps.
Okay.
And Are You Afraid of the Dark and stuff like that.
Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yeah.
Yes, Goosebumps was a good show. I mean, I haven't seen much of it, but that was a pretty good show, right?
I never watched it.
Kids, but...
Like, I got...
Well, it reminded me kind of Eerie, Indiana. Did you ever see Eerie, Indiana?
Yeah, that's Joe Dante's show, right?
Yeah, a great show. I mean, it was goofy, but it was these two kids, you know, it's not quite anthology, but each story was different, and they discover some other weird thing in the town that you know, the adults are, everyone's being controlled, or there's something going on, or the parents have been replaced by, you know, duplicates or whatever.
Yeah, I remember it was sort of like he made a weekly Invaders from Mars type TV show, and it was loved but not well received, I guess.
Not loved enough, I think. And they actually brought it back. I think not too long ago they did a reboot of it, you know, with like a different cast and everything.
Speaking of Joe Dante, you know, we forgot about Amazing Stories.
Oh, yeah, we did.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, that was 85?
It came out the same time as The Twilight Zone. I think Spielberg wanted Twilight Zone, but ended up with Amazing Stories. For me, it was a mixed bag of a series. There's some really good shows, and then there was some that were like, meh, you know.
I remember the Zemeckis one with Christopher Lloyd, head of the class, where he's a teacher. I forget the kid in it, but the kid was in lots of 80s stuff. There was the animated Family Dog, which was designed by Tim Burton, which ended up, you know, everything Tim Burton touched years later became a movie or a TV series or something.
Yeah.
And then the pilot with the World War II thing that had Costner and, I mean, all these faces in it that ended up doing big stuff. I don't know if it was directed by Spielberg or not, but yeah, it was hit or miss for sure. I always hated the opening.
Yeah, it was too labored, precious. I didn't like it either.
Yeah, but there was some good stuff in it. But did that last a season or two seasons?
Two seasons, if I recall correctly. The one that I have always really liked is the one with Mark Hamill.
I was just going to say, yeah. I remember the Mark Hamill one, yes, where he's a collector.
Yeah.
But didn't you feel like at the end of it, it was like, you know, he was alone in the gas station with this stuff, and everyone's like, "Oh, what is all this stuff?" But he was 90 by the time anybody paid attention to it.
Yeah, he's like an old guy, and he's gonna be rich. But yeah, it was. Yeah, I didn't say it was amazing. I just said it was the one
I
liked.
Kind of depressing.
Yeah,
it was kind of depressing when you. And I thought, what are they trying to tell us at the end of this thing? Where the guy's like, well, you know, he's like walking, he can barely walk, and he's all decrepit, and like, hey, you got a lot, I want to buy all this. Here's $10 million, and you'll be dead next week.
Yeah.
You know, I never quite understood why that was such a uplifting ending. But yeah, he was starting to pop up in lots of TV stuff.
Yeah.
But there was another show, and I can't think of it now, because you said amazing stories. I think there was another, like, late-night thing that I thought Hamill was in an episode of, or there was – shit, I don't know. The Dark was interesting watching that, because that was, like, my life flashed.
I can't wait to check that one, because I remember being terrified of that show. Just the starting scared me, and, you know, James Coburn's face. But, yeah, that's –
Well, Coburn's also, like, super cool in the opening too, where it's like he's not, tonight we're going to tell you something that's going to blow your mind, you know. He's like, he's doing shit in the dark room.
Yeah,
he's like, you see that picture, that's so-and-so Brian Hyler, let me tell you about that guy. Oh yeah, he's a good man. He's had a, like, he just kind of, he couldn't stop being Coburn.
Yeah, it's he's just oozing out of that show. Yeah
He couldn't get, you know, all Rod Serling or like whoever to just be like in a suit, you know, which is also interesting because it leads back to, and I'm curious what you think of this because you've seen one of the episodes, when you know someone primarily for comedy, Jordan Peele does the wraparound and the narration for the new Twilight Zone. And it's really hard for me. I feel like he's smirking the whole time. It just feels like he's
you're not taking him seriously.
Yeah. There's something about the delivery that's just not quite, I don't know. I'm not sure if it was the greatest idea to have him do the wraparounds, because it just kind of, it seems kind of, you know, he's got, I don't know if you've seen, you haven't seen Us. I don't think you've seen Us.
No, my family went without me. I will see it. Well, I didn't have the time when they wanted to go.
Well, I'm not going to give anything away, and I don't want to say how I felt about it, but there's a character in it played by what do you call it? Eric, not Tim Heidecker.
Oh, he's getting around. I just saw him on AP Bio this week too.
Yeah, he's getting around, but it's really hard when he starts talking to not just think he's doing a goofy character. It's hard to
there's
sort of
certain
take it
people
seriously.
Yeah, there's certain people, like, I could never probably watch a dramatic role by Tracy Morgan. I could never do it, because I just find Tracy Morgan, he could just stand there and I find him funny. So, you know.
Well, then you're going to get a big kick out of episode one of the new Twilight Zone.
Is that the one with, is the comedian one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do not like that lead actor.
I don't like him either. Yeah. I don't get it, man.
Yeah, I do not. I remember saying to myself when that was announced, I was like, well, I guess I'll watch the second one, because he's just, he's unappealing. That's all I can say. That guy drives me crazy.
He's the same tone and delivery every line he delivers. And that was my big hang up with the first one, kind of. But I do feel like this is sort of a crazy time for anthology stuff. There's another show on Amazon called Channel 400 or Channel 204,
Channel
404.
Zero?
Channel zero. There's no four in it. It's just a zero.
It couldn't have been more wrong.
I know. I don't know where the numbers came from. I know where the numbers came from, because there's a show on HBO called Room 101, which I get pissed off about, A, because it's not very good at all, but B, that it's the Duplass brothers or whatever. And it seems like, clearly you were aware of Inside Number 9 when you called your show Room 101.
It's Room 104.
Same room. Room 104. That's where the four comes from. Right there. That's it. It's all coming back around. The four comes from 104. Channel Zero, actually, very good show. There are six episodes, maybe. Like two or three of them, maybe three of them. Great concepts. Really good Not a massive budget, but there's a time travel one that's really smart. There's one with Patton Oswalt. There's also a show, speaking of Jordan Peele, on YouTube called Weird City, which is you know, comedic mostly, and it's a future where there's like two different, you know, the haves and the have-nots, kind of like in two different parts of the city or something. All futuristic stuff. And Hamill shows up in one of those. I think voice does. There's only four or five of them, I think, and they're a little hit or miss, but I thought they were fairly enjoyable. There's Black Mirror, the Room 104 that I mentioned, Inside Number 9, and I think there's another anthology thing that Peele is doing, maybe?
Really?
I thought he was doing another original anthology show. I could be wrong.
We didn't mention Black Mirror either. What do you feel about
Black
Mirror?
Well, I don't remember if you... here's the thing. I love Charlie Brooker because I've been reading his stuff for a long time. He used to do he had a website that was like there were joke TV listings. You know, like ouch my balls or you know whatever, the, you know, silly shows that, you know, became things, whatever. And this was like 15 years ago, and basically they were trying to sort of say this is where television is going. You know, like keeping it, like they were riffing on how bad television was getting. Well, then the BBC gave him a show, which was Charlie Brooker's Screen Wipe. I think he did one for movies, and then Weekly Wipe, where he just kind of ran through the events of the week and how media manipulates stuff or talks about stuff. Very acerbic, very dark, always has been. Then the first scripted show he did was called Dead Set, which was, I think, might be on either Amazon or Netflix or something. But basically it was a zombie, you know, his attitude was if you know, where would be the safest place to be if there was a zombie invasion would be the Big Brother house, you know, in the UK.
Yeah.
And so the show, the people in the house have no idea what's going on. And then some of the crew of the show start to discover it. And it's really, really dark, very funny at times. But Andy Nyman is the runaway star of it, I think, as the TV producer who Andy Nyman co-wrote and co-directed Ghost Stories, the portmanteau film I keep raving about as one of the best movies of the year. And it's very dark. And then Black Mirror. So I'm eager to see anything he does. I thought it was kind of a rough start for Black Mirror, and it got better. And I still think it's a little hit or miss, but I think the bulk of it I really like. It's very dark and it's pretty bleak and some really good commentary.
But I don't ever feel like watching it. Like when I watch it, I go, oh, that was really good. But I don't ever feel like, hang on one second, I got some popping up. I don't ever feel like a downer on Sunday afternoon when I'm, you know, drinking a beer. But every time I put it on, I'm glad I did, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah, it's kind of it's not necessarily a pleasant show. There have been pleasant episodes, and that's why I, you know, it's to me, it's behind Inside Number 9 episode for episode, the quality of it. But it is interesting that that one mainly says it's going to be some kind of future that's taking technology from now and showing you where it's going. But it could be something horrific. It could be something beautiful. It could be, you know, whatever. And when he sort of does the sentiment thing, you know, it tends to work. Did you watch the one he did, the movie one, Bandersnatch? Did you watch that one?
My daughter did. I didn't, no.
Did she do the thing?
Yeah, she did. Did she go through it? Yeah. And she kind of
What was her take?
She liked it, but I think it ended really early for her. I can't remember. So she was going to.
Well, that's the beauty of it. I give him just like the Inside Number 9 guys, when you find the Halloween episode they did, the live episode from October, and what Brooker did, they're basically saying, look, nothing is fresh, like nothing lasts. You really have to, if you want to use the medium in some way, everything gets spoiled instantly, whatever. So Brooker, this thing came out of nowhere. I didn't know anything about it, started watching it, and it wasn't until I was watching it when it gave you the option of what to do. And I just grabbed the remote and went, oh, boom, boom, okay. And then I saw it happen. I went, like, they're really doing this. He's really doing this. Well, when you finish it, Well, I did on a lonely Friday evening when I should have been out hugging someone. I was at home and I thought, yeah, I'm gonna watch it again. So I watched it again and made the opposite choice of everything I did the first go round. And there's about 6 or 7 different endings to this thing. And that, I mean, that takes a lot of thought. Like, that's a really smart thing to do.
Yeah. It got rave reviews. And I just, like I said, it's just one of those things, you know? But where I don't feel like watching it.
What about a lot of these shows we're talking about, mixed horror and kind of, is there like a straight horror anthology that you think of that stands out to you over the years? Or is there like a Canadian thing that you can think of, or anything that was a, you know, full on?
There's a couple of things I remember as a kid, like Road Dolls Tales from the Unexpected, which is a British show that aired here. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. That is actually on Amazon as well.
Wow.
And it's, Amazon Prime or whatever. And it's got the opening theme is by Ron Grainer, I believe.
Oh, no shit. Oh, wow. I love Ron Grainer. Yeah.
Your buddy Ron Grainer. Yeah.
It's been a long time since I watched that.
There's good stuff in there. Very dark.
Yeah.
Very. Well, there's some stuff that's just macabre. It's, even if you don't see it, what's implied is pretty. It's pretty rough. But my God, the few I watched, you know, Brian Blessed, Joan Collins, Gil Good might have been in one. I don't know. There's just a lot of. That's like early 80s, right? Was that what it was? 81, 82?
Yeah, I want to say I think it ran maybe about 6 or 7 years, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, I forgot about Tales of the Unexpected. Shit, that's a great one. That's great. What else? Anything else you can come to mind? Short-lived?
Short-lived, like Nightmare Cafe. Do you remember that? Like, the networks never quite gave up. It's Robert Englund, and it's a diner, and there's horror stories in the diner. That lasted
that was,
like an hour. Perversions
so
of Science.
Nightmare
was,
Cafe?
Yeah, Robert Englund was the cook, I think. And Perversions of Science. Do you remember that?
Was that a spin-off of Misfits of Science?
No, there is no spin-off of Misfits of Science, sadly. We got to do a whole show on that. It was a spin-off of Tales from the Crypt, because Tales from the Crypt was going to go into movies, and of course they were all terrible. Maybe the first one was okay, but that second one.
Is the second one the one with Debbie Harry? Is Debbie Harry in the second one?
No, the second one has Dennis Miller. Oh, God, it's bad. I saw it in the friggin' theater. What the hell was I thinking? Oh,
that was a
God.
Slow week. Slow
yeah,
week
I think
weekend.
I lived in an apartment at that time. I was bored.
No air conditioning. I'm going to the movies.
Yeah,
it's nice and
I
cool
didn't
in
have
there.
Air conditioning. It was Perversions of Science was basically instead of taking from the old, you know, comics from Tales from the Crypt, they took from like Weird Science and those kind of comics from EC. And of course there was a heavy sexualization to them, if I recall.
Yeah.
Like I think instead of a crypt keeper, it was a sexy, well, depending on your mileage there, sexual looking robot.
Hey, listen, you know how my imagination works. I get a lot of mileage out of a sexy robot these days.
I didn't really care for the show, but I watched it. So
I don't think I've ever heard of that.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever. Oh, that's another one. Shit. You just made me think of it. There's another show, a new CG animated show on Netflix that is executive produced by David Fincher. And I'm going to get the title wrong because I've gotten most of the titles wrong so far in this episode. It's called Sex and Death and Robots, or Love and Death and Robots, or something. And they're different length episodes. Really dark, violent stuff, futuristic stuff with robots and creatures and stuff. And just kind of dropped, I don't know, like a month ago or so, and I think I watched like 4 of them, and it was kind of, you know, one of them was kind of goofy about robots in the future not knowing what their place is, and then the first one is about you know, like a circle of death, like Robot Wars, but like to the death with these, you know, creatures and stuff. And it was kind of really bleak. But essentially, it's an anthology. Like, no two are the same with the same characters, you know? There was something else that someone just started, too, and I can't think of it. But what do you think the appeal is of the anthology show? What do you think about it is, I mean, most people want, you know, something that they can remember, something that's easy to remember with the same characters. And, you know, what is it about a show that, you know, each episode you don't know what you're going to get, kind of?
Well, I think there's a creative freedom to it. And that probably has a lot to do with why it attracts creators to it. You know, you could, it's just, I think it's a format that will never die for us. I think that the idea of getting something refreshed every week, a new story every week, with no continuity is something people enjoy. You know, I think things do get weighed down in their continuity. I think Doctor Who's been weighed down in its continuity many times. I think Star Trek has. So, you know, I think it's one of those things that we will never quite, we need these things. We just need stories.
I think you're right. I think the continuity thing, I think it's a palate cleanser.
Yeah.
When you get to a certain season of a show and you're going, you know, even with like Game of Thrones, which is back now, and I think it's a fine show. I'm not religious about it, but it's, you know, I got to do a refresher on who's doing what and what's the thing. And
yeah, me too.
You know, so if you come along with a show that's just like, here's the story, it's a Civil War ghost story, or it's a outer space horror haunting, or, you know, whatever. And like I've always said about, I think the two greatest shows, two of the greatest concepts in the history of television are The Twilight Zone and Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Doctor Who, we could go into that and dissect the minutiae of why.
It has an anthology quality to it. Because
it does. And yeah. it can go anywhere. They both can go anywhere. You're not really, when you say time and space, you can take the story anywhere you want, and you can have allegories about whatever, but you're not bogged down. And Twilight Zone is, you could, he did stuff all over the spectrum. I mean, those stories, not just Sterling, but the people that wrote, you know, for him, were all over the place. And so you've got that kind of freedom. And there's something about them that, you know, it's interesting that most of the, none of these are anthology shows that are like, you know, like the anthology version of, you know, Eight is Enough. Oh, they're going to do an anthology version, you know, a show telling Eight, it makes you feel good at the end of, all of these have a macabre, weird, you know, sci-fi, creature, monster, horror kind of thing to them. That all stuff, Hitchcock on, it's all, you know, there's not a lot of stuff that's, there was, you know, like there was, you know, I picked up a DVD of Armchair Theater, the British show Armchair Theater. Each episode is a different sort of play.
Okay.
But it's not quite anthology, but there's no through line of like, this is like maybe Love American Style would be an anthology show that's not, right? Because there was no through line to that except for, you know, sideburns and, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you know, dating.
You know what I wanted to mention too, and it's not quite horror or sci-fi, but there was a show on when I was a kid, and I think it came from the early 70s, and it was definitely Canadian made, but it was called Storytime Theater. And
Storytime Theater.
It had a lot of famous people in it, like Peter Benerz and Avery Schreiber, and Alan Alda was in an episode. And it was basically like a theater troupe doing stories for children. And it would, you know, usually the sets were just black sets, like, you know, but so it was a bit of a pantomime show. But the thing about that show that drives me absolutely crazy is they did the intro was this haunting version of a Rolling Stones song. So whenever Storytime Theater clips come on YouTube, the Rolling Stones take down, I'm not sure if Mick Jagger's doing this personally, they'll take down the starting. So the starting is silent. and it's driving me crazy because I want, like, the Stones version is nice, but I really, really liked this guy, this Canadian, it was a Canadian band who did it, and I cannot, like, my wife and I go crazy trying to find it because we both grew up on the show.
What's the tune?
Gosh, what is the tune? I do not wish to sing it to you, but it's,
The Stones are, the Stones might be listening.
No, yeah, I might get busted.
No, I heard Charlie Watts loves our show. He listens quite a bit.
Huge fan.
Big fan.
God, it was a role. I'm sorry, this just came to me while we were talking, and it was called Story Theater, and it was "Sing This All Together" by the Why Don't We Sing This All Together, but it was covered by a Vancouver group called Spring. And I cannot, for the life of me, find a copy of this song, and I need to hear it. But it was all taped in BC, and a lot of these people went on to big television. You know,
this is late 60s.
It's early 1971.
Okay.
So it's something that I vividly remember because they replayed it a lot when I was a kid. And I would absolutely love to get a copy of that song. But the show itself was pretty good. And it was an anthology series. So it sort of...
There was one that made me think of... There was one that was done in the early 80s on HBO when they were doing original stuff even back then called Fairy Tale Theater that Shelley Duvall...
Shelley Duvall, yeah. And it's...
did.
That one is very similar, and that's the one you usually find when you're looking for Story Theater. But yeah, I remember Shelley Duvall's. There was some Henson in that, wasn't there?
It might have been. Oh wait, that's one. That's a good one. Wasn't the storyteller? Isn't that kind of an anthology show?
Yeah.
With John Hurt and the Muppet Dog, which I always thought was pretty creepy. The story thing was there was some creepy stuff, but it was basically doing, you know, an anthology show with people and puppets because the stories themselves had people in them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or live action.
I don't think I ever caught it, to be perfectly honest with you. But
I saw it a few times, and I thought it was, but that was very much a British thing, I thought. Like, I thought it sort of launched over there, and, but yeah, but there's an anthology show. It's tough to say, but like, I mean, I suppose, like, the story theater or, you know, Love American Style or... Well, I mean, you know, it was a dating show, but it was a different story. You know, maybe there's a show called High Maintenance. It's on HBO about the pot dealer dude. He doesn't have a name, but apparently it was like an internet show or something, and then HBO picked it up, and each you know, he's a dealer, and it's, you know, each show is all about weed, basically. Everyone in it just, you know, smokes weed all the time. But, he's the through line, sort of. But then I take it back. No, that's not even true, because they have picked up bits of his story throughout. Although each episode, there's a couple of characters. It's like two stories going on concurrently, and you never see those characters again. But he's kind of more, they pick up more personal stuff with him within the show. So that doesn't even, I don't even know if that counts as an anthology show. Because
that goes into the Doctor Who thing where there is a protagonist and you start to learn more and more about the protagonist and they get involved in the story. So I don't know if I'd consider that a pure anthology show.
Right. Yeah, they're special. I think that's exactly it. I think you're absolutely right that we start to get bogged down with the mythology of stuff.
Yeah.
I was a big X-Files fan, you know, still am, still love that show. But I always liked the standalone episode, the creature stuff and the weird stuff, or the, you know, one thing's about time travel or whatever. I always was more into those than the mythology that just got up its butt after so long that you didn't know, you know, who was coming or going, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
I think that's it. I think we need a palate cleansing.
I think the anthology show has a strong future. In fact, I think more and more...
It will live forever.
Yeah, we will see some really interesting things, especially with all these platforms. And now Marvel has announced What If is becoming a series for
that
Disney Stream.
That might be what I was thinking of. Yeah. Yes. and each one, like, they're doing a what if, what's her name, got Captain America's powers, had the serum.
Yeah, it's got Peggy.
What if Agent Carter had it? Yeah. Because
I hate looking at Haley Atwell. That will be terrible for me.
Yeah, because I really want her to be 9 feet tall and completely butch.
I love her.
I love her, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was it. That was the one. There you go.
Happening. So we got some neat stuff coming up.
Yeah, I think we owe it all to Playhouse 90.
Playhouse 90.
And Rod Serling. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Who'd have thought, huh? We always went out of left field. No one thought we'd do anthology. That was too highbrow for us. But look at that. We did it.
They said we couldn't do it.
They said we couldn't do it, and we did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, there you go. Is that a show?
That's a show, and hopefully we don't lose it like the last one we did, which we're gonna have to redo.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I can't redo this gold that I was throwing down here.
No. I think we got this. I think it is record.
No way. I can get that back.
Yeah.
That was like the Magna Carta. Right
so there. Everybody, run to YouTube to watch Dark Room. And
yes,
we'll discuss it in the Pod Stallions Facebook group.
Twilight Zone, the original Twilight Zone, I think is up on Netflix right now and or CBS streaming.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know what people think of the new Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it's on TV here, eh?
The new Twilight Zone?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Well, get to the other. I'd like to know what you think of the first three, if you get to them.
Yeah, I just realized it and caught the fourth episode, and I thought it was pretty decent. I'm curious to see how this goes. I'm hopefully optimistic.
Let me just say this: this will be the best summing up of the review, whatever, without getting into detail about the other Twilight Zone episodes. You go back and look at these original episodes, and even the weakest of them, there's some brilliant stuff in it, and brilliant conceptually. I mean, really far out stuff. Not just the allegory about, you know, I think these people, it might be Martians, and everyone starts fighting, and look, man, it's inhumanity to man, you know, the Roddy McDowell one with the zoo and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just some really, really far out concept, like a coin, a nickel, that the guy tosses a nickel into for the newspaper guy, and it stays on its side somehow. And without knowing it, he can read people's minds throughout the day. Never an explanation for it, but then when the coin falls on its side, he no longer has the power or whatever. Like, just some far-out stuff. So when you hear Jordan Peele is executive producing a relaunch of The Twilight Zone, I feel like this is going to go into really interesting, dark, creepy. There's an unsettling thing in a lot of Inside Number 9. There is kind of an unsettling feeling as you're watching it, because there's one in particular I can think of in season 3 that is still hard to watch. Absolutely brilliant, having to do with crossword puzzles. But where it eventually goes is really hard to watch. I haven't gotten a sense of any of that in these new Twilight Zones. I feel like this is on the level so far of the 1985 reboot, other than a few, you know, swear words or F-bombs or whatever. So I'll leave it at that. That's all I'm going to say.
It's very, very interesting. Do you remember, just closing on this, do you remember Saturday Night Live in the 80s when Randy Quaid was on it? He did a really funny parody of The Twilight Zone. I think it was called The Limits of the Imagination.
Yes.
And he was like a floating head talking to you, and he'd do things like chew tinfoil, you know. To make everybody.
Yeah.
But I just remember there was one episode where they did three stories, and every story ended with the people just being in an alien zoo. Like, that was the stinger of every episode.
I remember that. That just got unearthed not long ago. Someone, you know, one of those random internet articles, like, let's take a minute and remember the Randy Quaid, blah, blah, blah. And I watched it for the first time, and, you know, since it aired.
It's a strange season. Like, it's a really.
Yeah.
Bad season of Saturday Night Live. Like that's just Robert Downey Jr. and Anthony Michael Hall years.
Anthony Michael Hall. Like Anthony Michael Hall. I mean, he just seemed like nothing but out of place in that show. And Robert Downey, people forget Robert Downey Jr. was a cast member of SNL. What year was that? Like 86 or something?
Yeah, like I want to say 86 or 85. Really weird.
So basically that was after Christopher Guest, Billy Crystal.
Yeah, that Ringer, you know, season. Yeah.
Harry Shearer, which was, I think, two seasons maybe with them.
I maybe? Remember it was like the ninth grade because we had a jukebox in our school, high school cafeteria, and it had that You Look Marvelous song, and some jagoff would put a quarter in every day for a month. Oh, that was awful.
Boy, that whole album did not age well, because I think he does...
It's a classic.
I think he's not only the music, but I think he does Sammy and Tina Turner on that album, like tracks, or like on the, I remember the video, or like the graphics of the album, because I used to look for all the old Python records, you know, used record bins and stuff, and the import stuff, and I'd come across that album, and you'd look at the back of it and go, oh my God, he did Tina Turner too? that's not gonna, you don't want to get that, bring that, you don't want to re-release that album.
I think, did he played Sammy on the show too, didn't he?
He played Sammy on the show. Yeah. He did, the whole thing was, who was the guy he was doing, Llamas, Fernando Llamas or something?
I can't remember,
I think it was Fernando Llamas.
I know it's my fault, but how did we get here?
It is your fault because you mentioned the Randy Quaid sketch from SNL.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah. There you go.
Well.
All right. Well, chew on that, people. Chew on that bit of tinfoil.
Thank you again for listening, and we'll be back sooner than later with another installment of Pod Stallions.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care. All right, man. That was awesome.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Let me know if it. Just do me a favor and shoot me a text. Let me know it worked.
I tested our last conversation, so it did work. So.
Good. Okay.
I'm still saying recording, but I think we're in the clear. So.
All right. Good stuff, man. That was good and long, right?
Yeah, that's a fine episode. I am tired of being here.
All right. Cool, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Have a happy Easter.
Bye bye.
See ya.
Yeah. You too, man. Bye bye. Bye.